This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
Today we are covering the first ever episode of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Book 7, the final installment, Chapters 1 and 2. The Dark Lord Ascending and In Memoriam. And then Dark Lord Ascending, that just makes me think of, I didn't know the Dark Lord was a Zodiac option.
It is? I didn't know this.
Like the Scorpio rising, ascending. Your rising sign. That wording. And I'm just like, I just think of like Capricorn or Scorpio rising or ascending.
Oh yeah, that's funny. I was like, sometimes they throw new stuff in there all the time. And I'm like, well, what? Yeah. Anyway.
So, Dark Lord Ascending in Chapter 1, Voldemort knows how to hold a staff meeting.
I don't know. I hope there is never a staff meeting where somebody is like twirling above head. So, that was very, very creepy. But yes, I guess so.
Yeah. And Chapter 2, not recap, but a little info about Double D.
Yeah, I kind of liked how they went about the recap, but we'll talk about that in chapter 2.
Yes, indeed. But lots of tidbits that we don't even think to think about because Dumbledore shows up as the Merlin-esque, old wise man with all the answers, and we're not used to seeing him. Like, what? We knew he had a brother, but we did not know about the sister. Or the father, or all that crazy shit.
No, a lot of like just realizing somebody's human. Has a life outside of being at Hogwarts.
Indeed. So let us get into chapter 1. Well, first you said you had a complaint.
I had a complaint, and Jim Dale, I love you, and I love listening to your readings of Harry Potter, and I know this was not your decision, but they did not, in the Jim Dale audiobook version, read these two, I don't know what you would call them, bits at the beginning of the book. The epigraphs, I guess is what they're called, about this weird little poem and something about death.
Oh, the torment bred in the race. Okay. I even forgot. Again, I was listening to the audiobook, so I even forgot that this was here.
Okay.
So discuss your thoughts, because I forgot about it.
I mean, I guess like the theme of death is going to be a big theme in this book, but
what is the title of the book, Jess?
Exactly, The Deathly Hallows. So we're like really sending it home here. But it kind of caught me by surprise because I was like kind of doing a little bit of rereading before we got on the podcast, and one of the recaps mentioned these, and I'm like, wait a minute, what? I didn't hear that. So yeah, that was my only complaint. So this was very like new to me as of, right before we started recording.
Yeah. So. I don't know, that just, seeing this like little poem or whatever, as you know, I mentioned off mic, I'm starting to go, I'm 2/3 into the Shakespeare sonnets, and death has not been a like poignant theme. Like, it has been a theme in terms of there are several a lot of the first few poems in the Shakespeare sonnets are about like life is more fulfilling if you have a child and if you have a legacy, because you know you're gonna die and no one's gonna remember you. It's less about like death in terms of like what lies beyond, like the way it's kind of in this, in okay. these ones.
Interesting.
Yeah. So.
Well, beyond that, that was my only complaint.
Okay. Moving on, I really want to get a hold of the was it Stephen Fry version.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
British version, because no one says that Jim Dale is bad, but they just say Stephen Fry is just phenomenal.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. So, okay. Chapter one, The Dark Lord Ascending. So we have, again, a chapter that does not have our lovable hero.
Yeah, which this starts like it did in, is it book four or five? When...
Again, that started in book four with the Riddle okay. House.
Yes.
And then it didn't happen again until book six, you know, with the minister, the prime minister and the minister of magic talking to each other. And then we got the extra chapter of Snape, Bellatrix and Narcissa at his house.
This kind of just reminded me of the book four, you know, mm-hmm. For some reason, but much, 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 much more scary. It's scary. It's a scary chapter.
Yeah, so we've got two guys in hoods apparating, pointing their wands at each other, and it turns yeah. out to be Severus Snape, which, by the way, don't know when exactly this episode will air, but we are recording on January 9th, Severus Snape's birthday.
Happy birthday. Not really, but I don't like you, Severus.
Yeah. How old is he? How old is he now? He would be 63 now. Yeah, he would be 63.
Oh, well, all right. Because
he was born in 1960. Yeah. And obviously January 9th, that makes him a Capricorn.
Well, that makes sense because that's my opposite. So
that's why I hate him so much.
Yes, exactly.
Yep. And so it's Severus Snape. And then it's a Death Eater we've never come across before by the name of Yaxley.
So this was interesting because I was like, have I heard this name before? It reminded me of another name, which was Kingsley Shacklebolt, which I don't know why. I kept like, I knew it wasn't the same person, but for some reason in the reading of it, I was like, maybe. Mm. But so, okay, good. We have not encountered Yaxley. That's a pretty unique name. Yeah. So.
Pretty unique name, and so they're strolling by, and they're going up to this manor house, and were you surprised of whose house this was?
Kind of, but then kind of not. I know that's a stupid answer, but I mean, I guess I was surprised in the manner in which Voldemort was in the house. He did not seem like he was a welcome guest.
Yeah, so, because we've got, I will bet you anything that Lucius Malfoy's Patronus is a peacock.
Yeah, because of the white peacocks. And they're kind of giving him a bad time about being, like, a little bit, like, you know, kind of
I believe the term, what is that term they would use in the olden days? Fop?
Okay, I've not heard that.
You've never heard that? It's kind of been a term used in, like, the 18th, 19th century to describe, like... a really effeminate man.
Oh wow. Okay. I know I've never heard
you
that.
Know, possibly maybe used, you know, to
like a derivative of the
a derogatory, possibly gay.
Okay. Interesting. It was kind of like it definitely fit him. White peacocks. That's pretty interesting. Yeah,
he always did himself well, Lucius. Peacocks. He actually thrust his wand back under his cloak with a snort. So yeah. But this is exactly why I like Lucius Malfoy as a villain, because he's much more suave. You're muted.
Yeah, I was trying to... The little flourishes are always kind of fun with the villains.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so they go into the drawing room, and it's, you know, most Death Eaters are there, and... Not just the Death Eaters are there. What'd you think of the revolving prisoner in midair?
I hated it. That's what I thought. And I absolutely hated it. It was creepy. and horrible. And I think that that always, sometimes those, it wasn't gory. So, you know, some people think that, I guess like my kind of horror is that kind of, you know, the unknown, not like splatter gore. That's not really my scene.
The but ominous.
Yeah. Just kind of like the what's not there or what is in your mind is usually darker than, you know, what is actually happening. So this was one of those instances that I was like, this is not fun. Cool. Like as in like, I thought it was like a cool, creepy thing, but yeah. Didn't love it.
And so we've got Yaxley and Snape, and there Voldemort is in the house in front of the fireplace.
Blech.
And set. And Voldemort's like, you know, Regina George, you can sit by me.
I don't like him.
Yeah, so as we see in the dynamic of Yaxley being a little petulant, that clearly Snape is the favorite right now. Snape's the teacher's pet right now.
Yeah, well, he did the kind of like, he killed Albus Dumbledore. So, he's the reigning king.
Yeah, he's the head honcho as of now.
Yeah.
And so they're discussing the prospect of how and when Harry Potter will be transitioning from his aunt and uncle's house to the... Sorry.
That was cute.
My cat Gyro. Well, you know what? You know, it's because where my laptop is right now, there was a mountain of clothes and he was made a bed for himself.
Aww.
And now he's like, where's my nest?
Those cute.
Yeah. So, yes, Gerald. As I was saying, so they're discussing Harry Potter and how and when he will be moved from his aunt and uncle's to the safe house. And there's a little bit of a debate about when this will happen. And Snape and Yaxley have had different information. And Yaxley throughout this whole thing is being, again, really petulant, like, you give me attention, Voldemort, give me credit. And it's like, again, why do these people follow this man? This man has a terrible business model.
Yeah, I mean, like, this guy sucks. That's what I was kind of thinking. Everybody's just kind of, like, falling all over themselves for him. And I guess it's just fear, you know? But how did he also find these people if he dislikes them so much? I don't know. I had a lot of questions about the, just, like, why would I want to hang out in this situation? Again, and we'll get to it, but the Malfoys' kind of reaction to all this is very, very interesting.
Yeah, so basically Snape is of the mind that the Ministry of Magic, and so the Auror Office, has no involvement in Harry Potter's safety anymore, because the Order of the Phoenix does not trust any aspect of the Ministry at this point. And which is the right to not trust it, because as we learn, Yaxley says he has placed the head of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement, Pius Thickness, under the Imperius curse.
Yeah, dark.
And we are discussing whole governmental coups.
Yeah, there was a lot of like logistical discussion here about government coups and insurrections.
Oh my god, you know, it wasn't until January 7th where I just passed, and it's like, oh, it was the January 6th, like the 2-year anniversary, and it's like, it doesn't feel like it's been that long, because it's just constantly been in the news, like non-stop.
Yeah, I watched a documentary about that this past week called This Place Rules, and it was just, people are crazy.
Was it good?
Yeah, it's good. I like the person, Andrew, who does those like interviews. Yeah. I like his style. It's very, very rough, but I like it. So he's like a skater guy.
Yeah. So one, just brief tangent, then we'll get back to it. One of the long-term partners of the policeman who either was killed at the protest or committed suicide afterwards is now suing Donald Trump directly for wrongful death, like via, you know, inciting violence.
Good for them. Like, yeah. That's, yeah, hell yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, so we, yeah, talking about governmental coups, and then we've got And then he's like, yeah, I must be the one to kill Harry Potter. And it's like, and him saying, like, he has survived more because of my mistakes than any talent on his part.
That was surprising to me, because he's, I feel like a lot of time the villains are always like, oh, it's everybody's fault but mine. But he is kind of like, oh, it's my bad that Harry Potter's still alive.
It's basically, in essence, a humble brag, because obviously it's the lesser of the two evils than admitting that this child actually has some form of merit.
That is a point that I missed, but you're exactly right, because he is the only one that's, like, powerful enough to do it or whatever.
Yeah, because most of the time, Voldemort is that type of villain who has a shit ton of hubris.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, him... This is about, to me, this is humble bragging to, you know, skate around the issue of, no, it's not about the boys. The boys, nothing. I've just been, you know, careless.
Right. Yeah. Ooh. Yuck.
Yeah. And then, but as we know from the end of book 4, for Voldemort to confront Harry directly, they cannot use their own wands, because their wand shares the core and there's the connection and the crazy, glittery, glowing, spiderweb crap.
Yeah.
So, because of that, Voldemort is like, I need someone else's wand. And no one volunteers. Not even Bellatrix volunteers her wand. No one.
She drives me crazy, but,
Which, I don't know, I guess we're supposed to understand by now in, like, wizarding culture that, like, your wand is your wand and, you know, your wand chooses you and therefore it's very customized, it's very personalized, like, you know, one would only use a different wand in, like, an emergency, you know, situation.
Probably a stupid analogy, but it's making me think, like, is it like the equivalent of like giving somebody, I want your phone, like that phone's mine now, the way it's set up, like if you couldn't clear it?
Yeah, possibly. Cause at first I was surprised because I thought that, again, they're so desperate for his approval. I thought there would be at least a few who would be confident enough in their positions that, like, yeah, I can give you my wand temporarily. But all of them understand that this is such a dangerous situation they're in, whether it's Voldemort directly or everyone else, all the Death Eaters around them, that to not be without a wand in this type of company would be suicidal.
Okay.
To not be able to defend yourself.
So he basically has to take one from somebody.
Yeah, so the teacher decides to pick someone. So Lucius, don't see why you need to have your wand anymore.
Which, first of all, it's surprising that Lucius is there. Because he was in Azkaban, right?
Yeah, yes. And so, as we can see, Voldemort has released Lucius from Azkaban. And so, now he's back and he's not very happy, is he?
No. All the Malfoys are very kind of morose.
All the Malfoys are not happy campers. They are not very gracious hosts. And I think Dumbledore in the last book made a quote about, ah, poor Lucius, you know, him destroying the diary, which ended up being more important because it was a Horcrux, and getting caught at the Ministry. Dumbledore says something to the effect of, I would not be surprised if Lucius is glad he's in Azkaban at the moment, because he probably knew that coming back to Voldemort, that in essence, the Malfoys have fallen from grace.
Yeah. Gross.
Yes, and so we have Lucius giving Voldemort his wand, saying it's elm and it's made of dragon heartstring, and everyone kind of snickers because Lucius offers his hand as if, you know, yeah, I gave you your wand, so you're gonna, you know, I gave you my wand, so you're gonna give me your wand, and Voldemort just laughs.
Yeah, it kind of felt bad for him. It's kind of embarrassing, but also it was kind of like involuntary, but also like, do you really think the Dark Lord is going to give up his wand? Like, no, come on, man.
Yeah. And then, so yeah, the Malfoys, none of them are happy, and Draco's not happy. Lucius not happy. Narcissa's not happy, but her sister Bellatrix, you know, it's all hunky-dory, and she's like, you know, of course, what is it? She's like, my lord, it is an honor to have you here in our family's house. There can be no higher pleasure. And Voldemort's like, no higher pleasure. That means a great deal, Bellatrix, from you. And a lot of people have interpreted this as there possibly being a sexual relationship between Bellatrix and Voldemort.
I got a little bit of that.
She would love to, I'm sure, but he wouldn't. I don't think.
I kind of felt like she was more had a thing for him for some dumb reason because he's horrible. But yeah, but he like kind of knocks her down here in a second.
Yeah. So I don't know. I was just thinking about just overall the psychosis and, you know, obviously Bellatrix is supposed to be just this totally insane character. And it's like of all the Death Eaters, like, you know, we have the Suave Lucius, we have, you know, various, you know, archetypes of, you know, villains and minions. Why is the crazy psychotic one the one of the few female Death Eaters? Why is the woman the psychopath?
So, okay, I'm going to make two arguments, because the first one is it's always like women. We've always got to be the crazy one, right? Like that's always the thing, the crazy woman, and kind of adding the like lust element is kind of pretty cliched. The second I thought about is like a male counterpart on this level is the association of like violence, too strong that they didn't want to include, or like that is something that we didn't want to talk about. And I am thinking of Renfield from Dracula. Like, you know, he was out of his gourd serving his master, and very effective. Like, was there a sexual element to that? I don't remember. Probably Dracula was sexual all over, but yeah, I don't know. It's probably just sexism. Like,
yeah. And so Voldemort says again, no higher pleasure even compared with the happy event that has taken place in your family.
Mm-mm-mm.
Yeah, your niece has married the werewolf Remus Lupin. You must be so proud.
So
what'd you think of that piece of news?
Well, we talked about Tonks and like there was like an age difference, and there was kind of a at the end of the last book. But I wasn't surprised. I just thought it was kind of annoying that like Voldemort brought it up. So I wasn't terribly surprised. But good for them. Congratulations to the happy couple. I don't know.
Yeah, so what say you, Draco? Asked Voldemort. Will you babysit the cubs?
And then that gets a big laugh, a big fake laugh from everybody around the table.
It's just interesting, the dynamic, because, you know, they clearly look down on werewolves, but he has totally enlisted the help of Fenrir Greyback and, like, his pack and wolves to, like, do his dirty work.
Yeah. It's kind of typical villain behavior. Like, as long as you serve my interests, then it's fine.
Yeah, it's just it. And I'm just thinking about the notion of, again, like, whether it's, again, werewolfism, lycanthropy, or whether it's sex, again, whether it was consensual or not, just the fact that it happened, that suddenly taints your character as a human being.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah, it is weird.
And, so then what we got? He's like, you must prove... Was it? Many of our oldest families become a little diseased over time. You must prune yours, must you not? Keep it healthy, cut away those parts that threaten the health of the rest.
I don't know. I was just like, shut up, dude. Like, oh god, this is so annoying.
Yes, and from that we finally get to who is actually floating and spinning around, and it is Charity Burbage, who was the Muggle Studies teacher at Hogwarts.
Yeah.
And what was it? Not content with corrupting and polluting the minds of wizarding children, last week Professor Burbage wrote an impassioned defense of mudbloods in the Daily Prophet. Wizards, she says, must accept that these thieves of their knowledge and magic, the dwindling of the pure blood, is, says Professor Burbage, a most desirable circumstance. So she would have us all mate with muggles or no doubt werewolves.
He's just taking his like villainry, I don't think that's a word, to another level, because she didn't, from what I understand thus far, she didn't do anything to directly, like...
No, she's not part of the Order. She's not She's not doing anything, like, in espionage or militarily. She just had the opinion of we should all get along.
Right. And which was super, so offensive to him that he's, like, basically tortures and kills her.
Yeah, basically. And, I don't know, the way he describes it, because the way he describes, basically, they frame their hatred of Muggle-borns as... somehow they must have stolen their magic, that they couldn't be naturally have been born with their magic, that they must have stolen their magic from somewhere else to be able to do magic and be part of the society. And it just makes me think of just, you know, I have been watching a lot of World War One and World War Two documentaries with my husband. And it's just the sense of all the stereotypes about, you know, about Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, again, obviously not giving any credence to it or anything, but I'm just like, what is it that they honestly think they can make the conjectures that Jews are the source of all the problems in the world?
Like, that's
this,
a great question.
Again, this crazy ass, they steal magic, or they orchestrate, the Jews orchestrated it, and so Germany lost World War One.
Yeah, I don't know. The origin of that has always just kind of baffled me. I mean, I guess if it's a faith-based discrimination, that's pretty
it's partially faith-based, and, you know, naturally, because there are certain notions of, like, again, of charity in Christianity, the idea of loans, the idea of interest, like, Christians wouldn't want to do that, but the Jews would, and so that the fact that they were the bankers, you know, in that way, or were very successful merchants because they engaged in very what's considered very modern business practices, when Christians would be like, oh, that's bad. You know, oh, that's bad. We don't want that, even though obviously by now we're a totally capitalist,
right,
you know, society. Yeah. But that still persists that, you know, they were willing to be the bankers for society when no one else would be, and then they get punished for it.
Yeah, that's pretty awful. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, and then of course, just the general, the Jews killed Jesus rather than the Romans.
Yeah.
Yeah, that weird. Anyway, so it just made me think of that, reading that little passage, just the levels of absurdity that bigots and racist and supremacists go to demonize the other group.
Yeah, and essentially killing an innocent. I mean, like you said, there's really no reason that this person should be killed. So, you know.
Yeah. No. So, yeah. So he, and it's so sad because, you know, obviously, Burbage, she worked at Hogwarts, therefore she knew Severus, and she just keeps, like, pleading with Severus, but then Voldemort just kills her, and she just falls on the table.
This freaking guy, Severus, I don't even know what to say, because there are so many instances, like, what his end game is, I will probably finally find out, but he's not making himself likable at all.
No, he's not. And then we end chapter one with dinner, Nagini, said Voldemort, and the great snake swayed and slithered from his shoulders onto the polished wood.
Blech. Gross.
Gross.
Horrible. Yes. Terrible. Poor Charity.
Poor Charity, and again, don't know how Nat would get through this chapter, because she's terrified of snakes.
Yeah, ugh.
So, and then we move on to chapter 2, In Memoriam.
Interesting chapter. The interesting kind of, like, a reflection on Dumbledore's life, yes, but then also kind of giving a brief, like, recap in an interesting way.
Yeah, so overall, in terms of general recap, Privet Drive, Dursley chapter is a fairly decent one, because we get a bunch of new information, because she has she must not need Harry the writer gives us plenty of he does this in the last book, of, like, showing the various articles strewn about his, you know, about his room and reading them to give us further context. So a similar thing happens here.
I liked this one better. It felt, like, more creative, because he's just kind of simply going through, like, objects and things throughout the books to lead up to this. And it just felt a little less obvious than the other one.
Yeah. So starts off with Harry's bleeding.
Yes.
Harry's bleeding because he's going through his school trunk and basically going into, like, again, me, like, going into the black abyss of my purse trying to find, you know, absolutely everything. And so there's the final layer at the very, very bottom of his trunk he just hasn't touched.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And he thinks it's a teacup, a broken teacup.
He goes to open the door probably to get some like towels or something. And there's a crunch and he had trodden on a cup of cold tea.
Okay. But when he's rummaging around in his bag or whatever, that's something else, which is
Yeah, so Harry scraped the fragments of the cup together with one hand, threw the rest in the bins, and then what do we got? So he's rummaging through his trunk, and he sees one thing he pulls out is, you know, a badge that says support Cedric Diggory and Potter Stinks.
R.I.P. Cedric. Yes, I do. Yeah,
remember those badges that Malfoy made?
Yes.
A cracked and worn out sneakoscope. Yes. And a gold locket inside with a note signed R.A.B. And then finally he discovers a sharp edge, so it's like a 2-inch shard of a mirror, and it's the mirror that Sirius had given Harry as a means of, you know, FaceTiming him.
Yeah,
that he never used.
That one was pretty painful.
Which I still don't forgive Sirius that when he was talking to Harry in the fire that one time, be like, next time you want to call me, use the goddamn mirror.
Right. Yeah, that one was just too much of a gut punch.
Ultimate Greek tragedy.
Yes.
And so what Harry's essentially doing is he's separating his possessions, the things that he is going to take with him and the things he's leaving behind. And he's leaving a lot of stuff behind: his school and Quidditch robes, his cauldron, parchment, quills, most of his textbooks were piled in a corner. He wondered what his aunt and uncle would do to them. Burn them in the dead of night, probably. And I'm just like...
Probably. That's exactly what they would do.
Yeah, there have been, on more than one occasion on this podcast, I have expressed my discontent over the book censorship and book bannings. And even burnings, and or at least even school board members saying like, okay, we're going to take these books off the shelves. What are you going to do with the books? And he's like, I don't know. I would burn them. And I'm just like...
Oh my gosh.
Again, when did book burnings suddenly not become distasteful? Please, I ask you. I want to understand.
I would love to know, because it seems to be quite the thing to do lately, which is very stupid.
Mm-hmm. And so what he is taking with him is his muggle clothing, his invisibility cloak, potion making kit, some books, the photograph album Hagrid had once given him, a stack of letters, his wand, and so they've all been packed into one old rucksack. And also he's taken Marauder's Map and the locket with R.A.B.
Yeah, all the remnants of books past or journeys past.
Yeah, I'm just like, no, don't leave the books with the Dursleys to be burned.
Yeah, no. No, thankfully we didn't have to deal with them yet. So I have a feeling we will have to next chapter, but...
Yeah, and so... He goes by a pile of old newspapers, and we get this article by Elpheus Doge. And so, again, your thoughts. So, go, please, discuss.
I thought this was very lovely. Elpheus Doge is somebody I don't believe we've been introduced to yet, but until now, obviously. But he gives a very kind of detailed... remembrance of his past with Dumbledore, and kind of goes into some things that, you know, I think as the reader, you are like, oh yeah, there was a life before he was this like big, huge figure, kind of untouchable, godlike figure. And Harry kind of comes to the same realization too, by the end of reading that he's like, oh, I never asked him anything about his life pre Harry's experience at Hogwarts.
Or even pre Voldemort.
Yeah. And, you know, Harry's kind of all about, and I think everybody can admit to being guilty about that sometimes, not being curious enough about somebody else because you're like, you know, you have an agenda and you, he's like always trying to move, you know, he's always in some shit. So Dumbledore's trying to help him out. So it was, I mean, and the Obit was, it was nice. We learned a lot. We learned a lot about Dumbledore that we did not know. I did not know.
Yes.
You did know because you've read this before. But I didn't
yes.
know.
And so basically what happened is when Dumbledore first came to Hogwarts, like Elfish Doge was like, you know, I wasn't very popular because I had the dragon pox and I wasn't any fun yeah. to other kids. But Dumbledore reached out to me and Dumbledore had this sort of shadow over him as well. He did not have any health issues, but he entered Hogwarts just as, you know, his father had been sentenced to Azkaban for seemingly brutally attacking several Muggle children.
Right.
And Albus never denied that this happened. Like, so that's how he started Hogwarts, like with, oh, your dad's in prison. Nice.
Right. That's, what a way to start. And obviously Dumbledore wasn't like talking about it constantly. Yeah. Dumbledore yeah. was also old as hell. So there's that.
Yeah. What? When was Dumbledore born? In 1899? Was that when he was born? Or no, or 1889. I forget. So anyway, in the 19th century. Yeah. So Dumbledore soon is able to kind of shed this sort of shadow because he is just so freaking brilliant and everyone adores him.
Right. He's charismatic, brilliant, all the things.
All things. All teachers love him. He's so talented. And Doge is saying, like, you know, when Albus and I left Hogwarts, we intended to take the then traditional tour of the world together. So obviously the wizarding equivalent of the quote unquote grand tour.
Okay.
Which a lot of people, and I agree with this sort of sentiment, that the sort of modern day college, like studying abroad a semester in your junior or senior year, that's kind of, to me, a modern rendition of the grand tour of going out in the world and finding yourself.
Okay. It was like, I don't know what that is. I know a lot of people, not me, that had like took a year off and like backpacked around Europe. But what is the grand tour? What is that? I don't know what that is.
The grand tour. It was when like gentlemen of the 18th and 19th centuries would like do the grand tour around Europe and just, you know, see the world.
Oh, okay. Okay. You know, Lucky them.
Yeah, it was something rich white boys of the aristocracy did.
Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense.
Yep. And then, so they were about to go on their version of the grand tour, but then Albus's mother, Kendra, passes away, leaving Albus as the eldest son to be the head of the family.
Yeah. So he has to, like, forgo this dream. And
yeah. And then not long after Dumbledore's mother dies, his sister Ariana dies.
Tragedy, tragedy, tragedy.
Yep. And I returned home to find a young man who had experienced a much older person suffering. Albus was more reserved than before and much less lighthearted. To add to his misery, the loss of Ariana had led not a renewed closeness between Albus and Aberforth, but to an estrangement. In time, this would lift. In later years, they reestablish, if not a close relationship, then certainly a cordial one. So, however, he rarely spoke of his parents or of Ariana from then on, and his friends learned not to mention them.
All right. Everybody's got their problems, I guess.
Yep. And then, basically, from that point onwards, he just doesn't talk about his family history or his personal life, and he just goes on to, you know, be a badass and, you know, take out Grindelwald in 1945, and everyone's thinking, okay, he's going to be the next Minister of Magic, but he never does.
Right.
And this...
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
No.
This is kind of like the nice version of what we're about to read in a little bit, where it's kind of like, you know, he didn't do it. There's not really any speculation as to why. It's just kind of like everybody thought he would be the Minister of Magic, but he never did. End of story.
Basically, Dumbledore was doing plenty of things beforehand and was a, rising star. But the thing with Grindelwald is they say that they felt like this was the turning point in magical history that was basically to match the introduction of the International Statute of Secrecy. You know, so him getting rid of the threat of Grindelwald in 45 was a big ass deal.
Yeah. Did he really do it? Or was we don't know, according to somebody.
So that's Doge's report.
Right.
And then Harry's, again, beating himself up because why didn't I ever ask him about, you know, it was always about me and my problems.
I feel like that's such a human response, though. I mean, losing people, you always think that, like, why didn't I do this? And it's like, well, I mean, we're human. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And then we've got, and he remembers, like, the only really personal thing I ever asked him was back in my first year. What do you see when you look into the mirror? I see myself holding a pair of thick woolen socks.
What the hell does that mean? I don't know. And I don't know if we'll ever know, but...
And what, because he says, another Christmas has come and gone, and I didn't receive a single pair. People insist on buying me books. Which, at this point, at 31 years old, I welcome both woolly socks and books as Christmas.
Amen presents. To that.
Thank you very much. I had to tempt myself not buying a lot of fresh woolly socks at TJ Maxx yesterday to make room for other things.
Both are wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And so from this, we get the interview someone has done with Rita Skeeter.
Barf.
So again, we don't know the nature because obviously we haven't seen Rita Skeeter since Hermione blackmailed her into making her do the article for on Harry's behalf. To get right. The word out that Voldemort is back, you know, with the and publishing it in the Quibbler.
Yes. Yeah.
And if I recall correctly, you know, Hermione said her only condition of letting Rita go when she had her trapped as a beetle in the jar, she said she has to keep her quill to herself for a whole year. So she only conditioned Rita Skeeter. You can't write anything for a year. So I don't know. I guess I'm curious about the dynamics of what Rita Skeeter's thinking is that if I'm going to publish something that's really disparaging, like, is this girl who's known to blackmailing me, is she going to be pissed off? Right. I guess I'm just thinking of why is Rita Skeeter so confident in going back to her old self?
That's a great question. I wonder if there's like... I feel like we don't really know enough about Rita Skeeter. We know she sucks and she's
and quite frankly, I don't think we know enough about you know, how Hermione was a gangster with her and what specific conditions or like what the hell that.
Right.
Yeah.
It's weird.
You know, it just seems weird because, you know, Hermione, as we know, she did not, as far as we know, she did not lift the curse on Maria Edgecombe's face with the pimples that say sneak. So she knows how to hold a grudge. So it just seems weird to me that she would be like, okay, it's only for a year. You can't write anything. I just don't see Hermione doing that.
Yeah. I don't know. There's a lot of questions because why does, you know, it's like Rita Skeeter forgot everything that she learned. So that would, to me, because obviously this is like a huge cash grab, would make me think that she's very like driven by material wealth, but I don't know.
Obviously. And she's saying that she wrote 900 pages in 4 weeks, which I call bullshit. She has probably been accumulating this for years and just sitting on it, waiting for Dumbledore to die so he can't sue her.
Just like those, you know, like TV stations, they have the in memoriam reel like ready to go just in case. So,
yeah. How long did they have all those sitting around for the queen and then it finally happened?
That's a great question. I wonder if anybody pulled the trigger too quickly. I think that did happen a couple times, but I don't remember specifics.
Anyway, so Rita Skeeter, her new project is, again, this like 900-page biography about Albus Dumbledore. Well, she says that, in essence, she just wants to, you know, trash talk Dumbledore, basically saying that there is something... Basically, she's like, he's not the happy-go-lucky man you think he was, and despite his, you know, anti-racist, you know, ideals as an older man, he certainly wasn't like that in his youth, and let's see what we got. I can promise that anyone who still thinks Dumbledore was white as his beard is in for a rude awakening. Let's just say nobody hearing him rage about you-know-who would have dreamed that he had dabbled in the dark arts himself in his youth, and for a wizard who spent his later years pleading for tolerance, he wasn't exactly broad-minded when he was younger. Yes, Albus Dumbledore had an extremely murky past, not to mention the very fishy family which he worked so hard to keep hushed up.
I think it's a little naive to think that he'd never like looked into the dark arts. So I thought it was a little stupid on her part, but the rest of it, I mean, she's making these huge claims, and obviously, I mean, again, he was very old. He had lots of time to learn and change his ways. So
yeah, but I said you'll have to wait for the chapters. And family skeletons notwithstanding, does Skeeter deny the brilliance that led to Dumbledore's many magical discoveries? He had brains, although many now question whether he could really take full credit for all his supposed achievements. As I reveal in chapter 16, Ivory Dillonsby claims he had already discovered 8 uses of dragon's blood when Dumbledore borrowed his papers.
All right. She's doing a smear campaign.
And Grindelwald. I'm afraid those who go dewy-eyed over Dumbledore's spectacular victory must brace themselves for a bombshell, or perhaps a dung bomb. Very dirty business indeed. All I'll say is, don't be so sure that really was this spectacular duel of legend. After they've read my book, people may be forced to conclude that Grindelwald simply conjured a white handkerchief from the end of his wand and came quietly.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the deal is, but...
I devoted an entire chapter to the whole Potter-Dumbledore relationship. It's been called unhealthy, even sinister.
That part was like, I was like, okay, you've gotten too far. Like, because there's an implication there that is not okay.
Yeah, again, your readers will have to buy my book for the whole story, but there's no question that Dumbledore took an unnatural interest in Potter from the word go. Whether that was really in the boy's best interest, well, we'll see. And certainly an open secret that Potter has had a most troubled adolescence.
Yeah, again, too far.
And I ask whether Skeeter is still in touch with Harry Potter, whom she so famously interviewed last year, a breakthrough piece in which Potter spoke exclusively of his conviction that you-know-who had returned. Oh yes, we've developed a close bond, said Skeeter. Poor Potter, he has few real friends, and we met at one of the most testing moments of his life, the Triwizard Tournament. I am probably one of the only people alive who can say they know the real Harry Potter.
Barf. This lady sucks.
Yep, and Harry is just
furious. Revulsion and fury rose in him like vomit. Yeah, exactly. Same.
Yeah. Oh no, just, what is that? You sit on a throne of lies!
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And he's like, oh, go ahead, sorry.
No, it's just, that phrase came to mind, but I'm like, where's that from? And I'm like, oh, that's Elf.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah,
the Harry too is bothered by an entire chapter to the whole Harry Potter Potter Dumbledore relationship. It's been called unhealthy and even sinister, and I think that's a big. She's making some very dark, big accusations with. I don't know. I mean, I know there's been a lot of discussion in outside of like the Harry Potter world. Is Dumbledore gay? I think he is, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, I thought that there was some back and forth with that, but I thought the newer movies like showed something, you know, some.
Yeah, it's, well, that was kind of the whole controversy when it came out that he was gay officially after the series, because a lot of people felt it was queer baiting, if you will, yeah. like trying to have a gay character, but not like fully commit to it so as not to offend more conservative, you know what I mean?
Right. This is not the implication that he's gay. I think that's kind of happened prior and you could kind of pick that out. This is like pedo like accusations, yeah. Which are, I'm sorry to say that, but like that's pretty, you better have some real hard evidence if you're going to make that accusation.
So Harry's just really pissed off. And then he sees a flash of brightest blue. Harry froze. He cut his finger, slipping on the jagged edge of the mirror again. He had imagined it, he must have done. He glanced over his shoulder, but the wall was a sickly peach color of Aunt Petunia's choosing. There was nothing blue for the mirror to reflect. He peered in the mirror fragment again and saw nothing but his own bright green eye. He had imagined it. There was no other explanation, because he had been thinking of his dead headmaster. If anything was certain, it was that the bright blue eyes of Albus Dumbledore would never pierce him again.
Tear.
Yeah. So what do you think of this? He felt like he saw blue in the mirror.
I mean, maybe he did. I think it's, you know, what is he? He's seen his parents in the... We don't really know the powers of this mirror, right? We knew Sirius could communicate with him, but I feel like there's always something else that isn't shared. So who knows? Maybe. I don't know. I don't think Harry's going crazy. I think he saw something.
Yep. And thus concludes chapter 2. First few chapters. And after our month-long Christmas/winter break.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you feel about being on the final book?
I think it's I was going to look and see when we started this, because it's been a long time. It's just crazy to read a book for this long.
A series.
Yeah. Well, and even a book, just to like space it out so much. But it's been very interesting. I feel like my niece, who I've talked about before, got Harry Potter trivia for Christmas. And she's like, we'll have to play. And I'm like, you're going to kick my ass. This is 11-year-old. But so when I'm done, I'll have to play Harry Potter trivia with
her. One of my Christmas presents from my sister this year was a little Harry Potter ornament. But it was a stack. It was a stack of the books and like detailed. It was a stack of the first three books. And then the final book was like in a triangle, like towered. And it was book 7.
Oh, cute. That's very cool.
Yes. So, shall we move? Or one thing I should say is this has traditionally been my least favorite in the series.
Wow. Okay.
I am hopeful that this go around as in my 30s rather than my 20s. I'm hopeful maybe that I can appreciate it a little bit more than I did in the past. And it's not even a question of the darkness of it. It's just more, it just was not how I envisioned the ending going, the final book being. And to be perfectly blunt, leading up to the release of this book, I read multiple novel length fan fiction that was basically, you know, fans' versions of book 7 based on what we knew from the rest of the previous 6 books. And I can honestly say that at the time, after I finished reading Deathly Hallows, I was like, there are some of those fanfic versions of book 7 that I like better.
This reminds me of, well, a couple of, how old were you when this came out initially? At 15?
When the final book came out in 2007, so I would have been 16.
16. Okay. Yeah, and I know you've reread the series more than then, but the first go around, you are reminding me of a book that I read called Fangirl by Rainbow Rowell. Have you ever read that?
No.
It's kind of deals with I think you would appreciate it because it's about a girl that writes fanfic, and it's like the conclusion of the series, and people are talking about how her fanfic is so much better than, you know, the ending. I don't know. It's a fun.
Is it a fiction or
it's just a little, yeah, it's a novel. It's a fiction. It's called Fangirl by Rainbow Rowell. It's fun. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So at the time, it just, my little 16-year-old brain, like, Deathly Hallows just veered off in a direction that I could not fathom at the beginning. And it just totally broke away from the structure of all the previous 6 books. And at that time, I didn't really like it. and I didn't appreciate, and I did not appreciate it. But I am hopeful now that I can appreciate it more. I could feel myself appreciating it just by listening to Amanda and Kevin's podcast as they went through the chapters. So I'm hopeful, as a more mature soul, I can, you know, get behind it.
Well, it's the first time. This is the part of Harry Potter I know the least about. So I feel like that up to, you know, I knew Dumbledore died. I know one death that I'm not looking forward to in this one, but I think I know a second one.
So tell me which deaths you're aware of, and is there anything else you know?
Hedwig, Dobby, I think, and one of the Weasley brothers, Fred or George, I don't remember which. Mm-hmm.
It was your niece's fault that spoiled you on Hedwig.
Yes, it was her fault. So, well, I'll give her a break. She was like 10. But the others are just like pop culture things. I think there's one. What is the other thing? There's something to do with Harry's parents and Snape. Still don't know what that is. I think Snape was in love with Lily, but the nuances of that, I don't know. Shoot, what else? I know Neville is involved in the defeat of Voldemort, but I don't know how. Mm-hmm. I think maybe I don't know. And then I know that the like end couples, I've known that mm-hmm. for a long time, like Harry and Jenny and Ron and Hermione. I think mm-hmm. that's all the spoilery things I know, but I really feel like this is the one I know the least about. So
yeah, you know, a lot of, obviously I don't appreciate getting spoiled if someone's doing it just to be, you know, mean or stupid, but you know, even with classics, like, to me, it's like, yeah, you may know what happens, but how it happens, like, that's almost just as fascinating, you know, about, you know, reading about how it happens. Like, oh, you could have a summary, but what was their motivation? What was their thought process? Like, all those things are fascinating, which is why we keep reading classics over and over again.
Exactly. How we get there, I don't know. I mean, like I said, I knew Dumbledore died, but I didn't know how. And mm-hmm. now I do, unfortunately.
Oh, it's sad. Alrighty, so shall we get in to Gothic Geek Out?
Yes.
Do we really need to? Do I need to ask?
No. It was the first chapter. And then, I mean, in the Gothic horror, like I said, I love the unsettling. I love and hate the unsettling kind of without gore mm-hmm. gothicness of that.
And that is kind of where I draw the line at gore as well. Like, the only horror I appreciate is the traditional, like, ghost story and suspense and the ominous feeling and, again, the uncertainty and the unknown, rather than just, you know, blood splattering on the wall.
Yeah.
You know, so that's definitely, you know, I think is more foreboding and not necessarily more foreboding, in the sense that that's what I like to watch, so I don't get so scared of it. Like, you know, it's what I'm entertained by. But if anything, like, that sort of, like, more subtle horror mm-hmm. is, there was one when I was at a sleepover and we were watching movies, like, I didn't want to watch, you know, and was scared of all the gore and monsters and shit. But when it was a horror movie that was, like, more of a ghost story and, like, super subtle and ominous, and I was like, wow, this is great, this is awesome. And everyone else at the party was terrified.
Exactly. That's always the scarier thing, the thing that's going on off camera. That's always, because your mind fills in the blanks and...
Yeah, whatever you conjure in your mind, because it's always going to be 10 times worse.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah, it's, that's sort of ominous. And then, if we want to get into further specifics, there are many things you could pick apart in that. There are so many things within Gothic's tropes. You have Nagini,
right,
who is, like, the sort of horror monster, this huge-ass snake that it's going to eat the corpse of a Hogwarts professor.
Right.
We have the trope of the fallen aristocratic family in the Malfoys.
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
That they have clearly bitten off more they can chew, and, you know, it's kind of been described, and I agree with it, is that Lucius, and by extension the Malfoys, they are the type of pureblood supremacists where they believe in the quote-unquote cause, they only support Voldemort because, again, their political, you know, their prejudices align. Like, if there was, like, a different candidate to, like, be leading this pure blood revolution, I'm sure Lucius would want to go with someone else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, someone of more, not this half-blood, crazy-ass, snake-faced terrorist. Like, he would want, he ideally would want someone who looked like himself, like, who was a pure blood aristocrat leading this movement.
That makes sense.
He's only throwing his lot with Voldemort because he's the only one doing shit.
Yeah, there's a easy comparison that we could make to a certain party and a certain person and other candidates, but
from the beginning when Trump was first elected, or even just nominated, was talking to my husband in the car, and I said something to the effect of, I hope the short-term gains they get with Trump is worth it, because long-term, like, people are going to remember who sided with him, who supported him, and it is going to destroy them.
Yeah.
And I love watching it happen now.
Yeah. It is only just playing out slowly but surely right now.
Yep. I'm just trying to think any other particular tropes.
I think with, like, killing an innocent person, like, I know I've kind of focused on that. That's pretty... I mean, obviously, you're kind of making sure you solidify the villain, that his intentions are not, you know, somebody did something to wrong me. It's just, like, it's purely just evil.
It's pure. It's entertainment.
Yes. And so it's
entertainment, making an example, but it's not even making an example, like, to other people that, you know, you shouldn't feel bad for Muggleborns. This isn't even making an example to wider society. These are people you've already converted and you're just killing someone.
Yeah. It sucks. So, but yeah, as far as Gothic, you know, it's pretty easy. Pretty easy this chapter.
Pretty easy. Or this
episode.
And then we can move on to Tarot of the Day, which I did not have time to pick one beforehand because I had a meeting with my student workers at 5:30. So I'm shuffling, and I have the Three of Pentacles.
All right.
From my special Crow Raven deck, if you see the three ravens. Well, obviously our listeners can't see, but I'm showing just the card. Three ravens. One raven is kind of picking at some cherries.
Oh, okay, cool.
So, let me look up on ye old Google Three of Pentacles.
Money, usually. Earthly objects.
Pentacles, money, the element of earth. Teamwork, collaboration, learning, implementation, general keywords. Let's see. Each person has an important role to play, and when they come together as a team, they can create something much more significant than if they were to undertake the project on their own. So the Three of Pentacles turns up in a tarot reading. Take it as a sign of to collaborate with others, creating synergies to achieve big results.
That's what they were doing in Creating Synergy, chapter one.
Let's have Voldemort lead a synergy workshop.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Some effective leadership, you know, that people always say that about, you know, anyway.
Yeah. People don't leave companies. They leave managers.
Just like the Malfoys want to leave Voldemort Inc., the Dark Lord Inc.
Dark Lord Inc. Dark Lord LLC. They have nefarious intentions, but certainly what they're doing is a sort of collaboration, because their whole thing is about, we were able to get one of the department heads under the Imperius Curse, and so one by one, we're going to pick off all the other heads of the department, and then we can take down the Minister of Magic, Rufus Scrimgeour. So they've got big projects in the works.
They do. They do. I would not volunteer to be their project manager, so I wonder if any of them have their PMP. Anyway, those are some... Sorry for the corporate jokes, everybody. But.
So the Three of Pentacles represents the value of different ideas and levels of experience and collaboration. The architects respect the specialized knowledge of the stonemasons, and the stonemasons appreciate the wisdom and experience of the architects. So the it's talking about, because, you know, obviously I have the Crow tarot, but in the traditional Rider raid, this card usually has both an architect and a stonemason, and the idea is that they have two specialties and they have different knowledge, but they work together to create something.
Okay, yeah.
And this If anything, I don't feel like this aspect of the card is being played very well in the first chapter, because it's, they're all, the Death Eaters are pitted, you know, they're getting stuff done, but in terms of trying to get Voldemort's favor, they're pitting against each other. And again, Voldemort's being a bad manager by not acknowledging, oh, these are your strengths, good job, Snape. These are your strengths, good job, Yax.
Right.
Again, shitty leadership.
Yeah, it's definitely a toxic work environment, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Again, just work environment.
Yeah.
Like, and then, even though their backgrounds, expertise levels are very different, they can come together to share their insights in a way that creates synergy and improves the finished product. There is no us and them or any sense of superiority. Oh!
Yeah, this totally. Does not apply.
Yeah, this does not apply. It is interesting, again, the notion of, like, the Death Eater, different people of different backgrounds, because that's very true of the Death Eaters, because we have the very traditional, like, pureblood aristocrats like Lucius, but we also have, you know, half-bloods like Snape, who do not come from an, you know, an aristocratic background. And if anything, you know, there's a funny parallel that Snape, obviously, by what he's done, he's killed Dumbledore, but there is a sense of Snape is so favored by Voldemort because he's exactly like Voldemort, as Harry says in the end of the last book, like, muggle father and yeah. witch mother ashamed of his parentage.
Right. Yeah.
With huge-ass daddy issues.
Right. Oh my god. Yeah. That could be another name for some of these chapters.
Yeah. So... yeah. Any other thoughts? Any other applications to the second chapter?
To the second chapter? I mean, I guess I don't know if we want to talk about, in a more positive light, some of Dumbledore's lineage, but it kind of doesn't really, you know, we kind of talk about the bits and pieces, but we're kind of talk about him in a little bit of a higher level kind of, you know, he did good. His family had issues.
Yeah. Well, really yeah. Just... yeah, the interesting notion that, you know, he's known, with collaborating with a lot of people, Nicholas Flamel, Bathilda Bagshot, like, again, he wasn't just singularly this awesome guy, he did work with people, you yeah. know, to create a better, you know, wizarding society, and so in that, overall in his life, he exemplifies the, you know, symbolism surrounding the Three of Pentacles, and Rita Skeeter is just trying to completely undermine that.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know. I guess I'm just thinking out loud, like, with Rita Skeeter again trying to like, oh, this is so scandalous about Dumbledore's past. And it's like, okay, even if it were true, even if some of the elements were true, just the fact that he, again, I've always equated him beating Grindelwald as 45 as he in essence stopped, you know, ended World War II.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Those things are intrinsically linked. So I'm just thinking, if you're able to get rid of, back then, wizarding Hitler, then you're allowed to have a few, like, missteps.
Yeah.
If you will. I don't know.
Well, I think we're talking off mic about things, you know, being knowledgeable of things that you don't necessarily agree with, or, you know, doing something and then realizing, oh yeah, that's not really, I don't know, testing the waters, whatever. As long as it's not like murder.
And I guess it's just interesting to because this is set, oh, I heard a kitty meow.
Yeah, sorry.
I guess it's just interesting for this sort of, oh, it's so scandalous that he dabbled this whatever in the past. And this is, and again, this is pre-internet, like, or intense internet or technology right. in the 90s. It's not like this is set in the time period of now where, you know, what you put on the internet is there forever to constantly right. be thrown back in your face. And so I'm just thinking about the dynamics of, like, he can't, like, this is so scandalous, and it's like, you know, outweighing all of the good things he did. I don't know. It was just interesting in this dynamic of, again, with shame and cancel culture and,
right.
you know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm just always grateful I don't have, like, a Facebook account that documented my entire college experience. Not that it is anything, like, horrible, but it's just, it's just nice to be able to be like, okay, that was in the past. And, you know,
yeah, I went from my Facebook, by the end of grad school, I went from being an extremely private person to an extremely public person because someone who was cyber stalking me infiltrated my page via whoever. And I was just like, okay, I have no privacy, so I might as well be public.
I don't know what to say. This is probably the most public I get, so.
Yeah. And I decided, okay, you want to torture yourself by watching how awesome my life is? Fine, here's all of it on public forum.
There you go. I do not have a Facebook page, so.
Yeah, I'm an old millennial. I'm still on Facebook.
Nothing wrong with that. I don't judge it. It's just not for me.
Okay. So now we can move on to, you know, the picking out the card from my Black Moon Astrology Oracle deck. And I picked card number 12, which is the Black Moon Lilith.
All right.
Mystery, because Black Moon, it's like a specific point in the sky, and you can have a zodiac sign in that.
Okay.
In that space. And my Black Moon Lilith is in Capricorn.
I don't know anything about that online.
Yeah, so, and I remember because I wrote a, it's about like the sort of darker feminine aspects it's kind of associated with. And I actually wrote a poetry series for like the Black Moon Liliths in each zodiac sign, which each being inspired personality wise by one of the female Game of Thrones characters.
Oh, cool.
So the Black Moon Lilith in Capricorn, I wrote a poem that was inspired by Daenerys.
Oh, nice. I like that.
Yeah, and so I did all of them. Like, I did, like, Sansa for Pisces and, like, Arya for Aquarius and, like, all sorts of stuff.
Cool.
Anyway, so, let's see. What do we got? It is time to be careful. Think of what might manifest over anger, bitterness, or revenge.
Whoa, yeah.
What you have worked so hard for may collapse. Astrologically, Black Moon Lilith represents soul expansion and cosmological awareness, the force in aloneness and the path of the individual. Black Moon Lilith is a dark goddess. She is a ghost to the moon. As a shift in power and consciousness, she symbolizes destruction before creation. The name Lilith means screech owl or night hag. Lilith is the ancient goddess of mystery and transformation. Stories of Lilith appear around 5,000 years ago in Sumeria, where she was said to have been the handmaiden of Inanna, the queen of heaven. Yeah. Although, however, most of us recognize Lilith from the Hebrew myth as the first wife of Adam. She also appears in medieval Judaic folklore as the rebellious first wife who refused to submit to Adam, blah, blah, blah. Throughout the ages, Lilith was demonized. She was first spiritual upstart, but in recent years, her status has changed. Lilith is a feminine force of command and strength. She represents the powers we hold in secret. When this card turns up during a reading, something lurks. Lilith appears as the dark part of the astrological chart. She is our shadow side, the dark force of the moon, where mysteries and unexplained occurrences lie in wait. This card indicates a call to wildness, even subversion. Lilith is the avocation of what may or may not be there. She can manifest as madness or self-realization. Lilith represents a refusal to submit, so it is not a good time to give in, even when the path seems a rough one.
Well, it's hard to think about Lilith and not think about femininity. You know, it's like, I feel like these are two very male-dominated chapters as far as the figures being Dumbledore and Voldemort. But when you talk, and Harry, always. But when you talked about the madness, I mean, obviously that's easy to think about Bellatrix. When you think about that.
Because, you know, Bellatrix is not rebellious in the sense of like magical pure blood, because obviously she married Rodolphus Lestrange, so she like did what was expected of her as a woman in terms of technically like marrying well, but she didn't have any children, and like literally she has up to this point she has not mentioned her husband once.
Oh, I didn't even know she had a husband. All right.
Yeah, because she comes originally from the Black family. She's originally Bellatrix Black, but then she married into the Lestrange family.
Okay.
So, yeah, like sort of the dark feminine of, you know, yeah. So basically, I don't know, this is a really bad, I've been listening to a lot of Shakira lately, going down nostalgic lane, and, you know, Shakira's, you know, She-Wolf song.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so so basically Lilith is supposed to represent the darker feminine energy. And so obviously immediately what comes to mind is Bellatrix, because she is the most prominent. There's only one of two named female Death Eaters. We haven't seen the other one yet. But yeah, she is the most obvious one, because the only other sort of dark feminine type we get, or at least in this chapter, is Narcissa.
Yeah, and she's like barely in it.
Narcissa is the typical, she doesn't have the dark mart, like she doesn't like go on raids or like do all the crazy stuff that Bellatrix does, what Lucius does, but she supports him, and she's the beautiful traditional trophy wife and pure blood wife who continues the pure blood line and has Draco and, you know.
Right. She's kind of like, arm candy, not really.
Yes. Yeah, at least, she's not into all the scheming,
Yeah.
As embroiled in it, she's just there.
Yeah. And then the actress who played her died recently.
Last year. It was so sad. That actress was actually originally supposed to play Bellatrix, but she was pregnant. But she was pregnant at the time and couldn't do it. And so they got crazy ass Helena Bonham Carter.
Helena Bonham Carter.
I don't know. I've been watching a lot of behind the scenes stuff about Harry Potter lately, and I don't know if this is true or not, but someone was saying that, there are points there, at least in one of the movies, where they had to ensure that they shot Helen Bonham Carter's scenes different from Emma Thompson's scenes, because, Helena Bonham Carter had that affair with Kenneth Branagh when he was still married to Emma Thompson.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh my gosh.
So, ooh. Yeah.
Yikes. I
I'm just like, that was a really long time ago. And she, and obviously they're not, Kenneth and Helen Bonham Carter are not still together. Like, she went off and didn't marry, but was in a long-term relationship with Tim Burton. And then they finally split together a few years ago. And so, yeah, I don't know. Wow. But anyway, if that's true, then that's, that's been a long time since that happened. But anyway.
That's funny. I was just thinking. I've been watching Wednesday, and Helena Bonham Carter is not in that, and that's a Tim Burton thing. So I forgot that they split with.
Because she's not with him anymore.
Yeah, thanks.
Otherwise, she's always.
Maybe she'll make an appearance.
Although Catherine Zeta-Jones, I haven't watched it fully yet, but I do appreciate her rendition of Morticia.
Yeah, I like the Gomez is not my favorite, but I'm only like two or three episodes in. But
well, again, Tim Burton said he was trying to go for like the original Gomez, like the comics, which was a more Rubenesque guy, but rather than the sort of Casanova-esque of the 90s that we're used to.
Yeah.
Which, of course, I like that one.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense if he's going on based on the cartoon. So, okay.
Yeah.
I'll forgive it then.
Yeah, so there is a historical basis. He didn't just throw out the Casanova archetype out of willy-nilly.
I had not seen like any pictures. I guess it was from the cartoon in the New Yorker. I didn't like dig that deep, but because I was thinking of the movie or the show in the 50s or the 60s, and I don't know. Anyway, Wednesday. It's enjoyable.
Alrighty then. And then we finally move on to our last exercise, fan fiction time.
Well, so mine was, and I know this is going to play, this is like, I'm already going to argue against my fan fiction as soon as I propose it.
Yeah.
But what if the person that Voldemort was torturing was Rita Skeeter instead of... Charity Burbage.
That would actually make more sense, because beyond just differing ideological perspectives, like, you could make the connection that you helped Harry Potter like expose the truth that I had returned before I wanted to, and therefore I'm punishing you. So that would actually make sense.
Okay, that's a good point, because I was thinking.
Did you even think about that point?
I didn't think about that, because what I was thinking of is, like, right now, she is kind of serving his interest by saying, like, Albus sucks, and trying to, like, poke holes in this, like, mystique, and maybe getting people on, his side. But I forgot about the that he might actually, you know, think she's trash. I feel like it could go either way. Like, I feel like he could look at it two ways. I think, I guess the way he's looking at it now is like, he doesn't even think about her. But
yeah, he doesn't even think about her. And because it's just the question of, do you want your, because you have minions that are blindly loyal, like Bellatrix, or you have, which you can trust them, but are they the most useful? No, because Bellatrix got herself locked up in Azkaban, and she was proud to do that, but she didn't have anything, she wasn't of any tangible use to, beyond showing her sense of loyalty, whereas Snape, by not, you know, flashing around Neil Green likes I support Voldemort, he has had several years more worth of intelligence that he can give to Voldemort and is much more useful to Voldemort because he doesn't appear to be as blindly loyal as Bellatrix. So I guess with Rita Skeeter, it's the sense of, does he see the value in her having, looking out for herself and be like, okay, she helped Harry Potter, but she can help me too. Like, or just being so offended, like, how dare you, you know? Yeah, so it's, yeah.
Yeah.
We talked about this a lot in our Sublimely Gothic Shadow of the Wind with that inspector. What was his name? Ferris? Or, you know, the inspector who was, you know, kind of on their asses all the time. And he, like, totally switched sides during the Spanish Civil War. He didn't care which side. He didn't, like, have any ideology. He just wanted power for himself.
Yeah.
So I feel I feel like Voldemort goes back and forth in terms of what he values.
Yeah, that sounds very Voldemort.
Mm-hmm. Whether he wants the loyalty or whether he wants, if the people who are not so blatantly loyal and sycophantic, they tend to be the most like strategic and useful to him.
Right. Yeah. Well, that was this go round. What about you?
I forgot to think of one. So I'm thinking right now, I am thinking, I don't know, I feel like, what if he was a little bit more aggressive and like, not full on torture. I just feel like for as much as he knows he's making the Malfoys uncomfortable, I'm surprised he's not fucking with them more and like punishing them more and terrorizing them more.
I guess I'm kind of surprised that Draco is still with us. Like, because I just felt like dropping into that scene, there's so much more that built up to that situation that we don't know about, you know? And Draco had the opportunity to kill Dumbledore and he didn't. So, like, why is Voldemort letting him live?
At the very least, we know... It's not shown like this in the movies, but, you know, it's only Draco and Dumbledore and obviously Harry who's immobilized under the invisibility cloak. And then Snape comes in. So, you know, even though Snape's the one who did it, Draco is at least in a position where no one can directly say, oh, he chickened out. Like, just circumstances and the chaos and everything. And Snape was the only one who saw it. So maybe they were able to play it off as, you know, Draco cornered. You know, cornered Dumbledore and Snape just, you know, picked him off. Like, they didn't see the whole turmoil to throw back in Draco's face.
Yeah, and Snape seems a little protective of Draco for some stupid reason. So, I don't know.
So, I'm just thinking, and again, he spent all of last year Voldemort like torturing Draco, you know, giving Draco this mission just to punish Narcissa and Lucius. So I'm just surprised that even the Malfoys get a seat at the table at this point in the context of everything that is happening.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, they are kind of very, at one point I think it was like, oh, it's such an honor to like have him in our home, you know, like falling all over themselves, but now he's like,
well, yeah, like, and then Voldemort's like, such lies.
Right.
It's like, if you know they're lying, then why the fuck you ask it, man?
Right, exactly. I don't know. That whole dynamic is weird, but I obviously don't think this is a person of logic and sound mind, so, you know.
Yeah, that's another thing I've been thinking about in comparison with these literary villains, and then watching all my World War II documentaries with Mussolini, Hitler, and Stalin, like, which of the ones were super, like, emotional and had hubris? Who was more strategic? Because at a superficial level, it feels like Hitler was the more emotional one, and Stalin was the more pragmatic and could think clearly. But even for Stalin, it took a while because, you know, the Germans just blitzkrieged through Russia for quite some time because Stalin purged all the generals who had either disagreed with him or, like, you know, offended him in some way and said they're going to invade, and he didn't believe them.
Oh my.
So he put his, like, ego over. So in some ways, Stalin was the more pragmatic one than Hitler. But at the same time, there was a period where he was putting his own ego over, like, military strategy.
Is that what got him killed? Like,
I can't even remember the whole. Well, Stalin didn't. Stalin lived a little bit after World War II, so.
I get Hitler. Is that what? I don't really remember his whole.
Oh, Hitler committed suicide on my birthday.
Oh, well, happy birthday. I don't know.
<That's>... Yeah, so, yeah, definitely, you know, Hitler was very emotional. And because he was a failed painter.
Yeah, and a vegetarian. People like to tell me that.
If I didn't share my birthday with him, I would think he's a Pisces.
Because of his emotions. Oh, that's funny. Oh, poor Pisces. They get such a bad rap.
When they're evil, they're bad.
When they're evil, they're bad.
When they're nice, they're adorable.
Yeah. Thankfully, I have very nice Pisces in my life. Yeah.
Right. Then any other thoughts?
What a way to start a book. That's my final thought.
Alrighty then. And so that concludes this episode, and we will tune in next week, and we will dive into chapters 3 and 4, The Dursleys Departing and The Seven Potters.
Okay.
Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophieMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophieMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophie Mare Studios podcast.